Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip started after Israel assassinated prominent leaders of the Al-Quds Brigades in a round of confrontation that lasted for more than 3 days, in which the Islamic Jihad movement responded to the crimes committed by the Israeli entity and announced the fight for the unity of battlefields. It had the upper hand in striking the occupied Palestinian territories, starting from the settlements of the Gaza envelope to the Israeli depth in what the entity calls Tel Aviv, with more than 1,000 missiles, paralyzing the pillars of the occupation. The outcome of this battle, as well as its main goal, was to unify the battlefields, as established by the Sword of Al-Quds War, and to confirm that the resistance was and actually still is united, despite the multiplicity of positions within it, but with one direction, which is the great battle against the Zionist enemy. Now, to discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan. Dr. Amal Wahdan is a human rights advocate. Thank you very much for being with us from the occupied Palestinian land, Dr. Amal. Now, in the battle of the unity of battlefields operation, Al-Quds Brigades claimed that it demonstrated its ability to confront the Israeli entity and to thwart the project of dismantling and separating the resistance battlefields one from one another, or to just single out one specific resistance group from the other resistance factions in the Gaza Strip. Do you think that the Islamic Jihad, in fact, achieved the goal that it claimed it did?
Yes, actually, the unity of the battlefield, despite all the efforts from the Israeli occupation for decades, who tried to divide these geographic areas, 1948, West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, despite all this, or despite of dividing, geographically dividing the Palestinian territory, it didn't succeed, actually, because the Palestinian people and the resistance group have always shown their ability to fight the enemy united. And the latest confrontation with the occupation, the Islamic Jihad, has proved that it could actually unite the different battlefields behind its effort to thwart the Israeli aggressions against the Gaza Strip. Last May 2021, it has been proved again that these battlefields are united behind the resistance and are united in confronting the occupation. So regardless of all the efforts that the Israeli occupation tried to do, they never were able to divide our united effort in confronting their aggressions against the Palestinian people.
Well, Dr. Wahdan, the unification of battlefields that the Islamic Jihad was working for after this latest experience against the Gaza Strip reveals that the isolation of the entity calls for the manifestation of a position regarding the continuous ongoing Judaization of Al-Quds, concerning also the incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the continuous construction of illegal settlements in occupied Palestinian territories, and the raids, the continuous raids against the West Bank in Nablus and Jenin and elsewhere, which all heralds the inevitability of a clash, or possibly even a war with the entity. Do you think that the regional resistance has an opportunity today, at this moment in history, to initiate an all-out war against the occupation entity?
Well, I mean, the regional resistance, or the axis of resistance in the region, I definitely can say that it is ready to wage comprehensive war against the Zionist entity. But it depends actually on other factors as well. First, the internal front, the domestic frontier in Palestine and among the Zionist entity itself, and it depends on the international arena. So the ability is there, their preparedness to engage in an overall confrontation with the Zionist entity is there. I think the moment is approaching where this overall confrontation is going to break out. And the Israelis actually know this, and their strategists always warn the political level of not pushing the area towards this sensitive point where they really have to face a regional front from the axis of resistance. Mm-hmm. So the Israelis are not ready to take this. And if it comes, they know that it's going to dismantle this regime once and for all. That's why the reaction of the Israeli occupation in the West Bank, in Nablus, in Jenin, even in Jerusalem, is accelerating to try to stop any unity in among the resistance in Palestine, inside Palestine, and together with the regional resistance.
As you were mentioning, we did see clashes escalating in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are witnessing basically sort of sporadic confrontations with the occupation entity following a campaign of raids and incursions launched by the occupation, especially in Nablus, as you mentioned, which resulted in the martyrdom of one of the leaders of the Quds Brigades, Ibrahim Nablusi, and his two companions, Salam Subuh and Jamal Taha. We are talking about 19 years old here and 20 years old young men sacrificing their lives for the sole purpose of liberation. How much longer do you think Israel can endure this new blood of resistance?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The more they challenge Palestinians and Palestinian freedom fighters, the more the reaction is on. And Ibrahim, Islam, and Hussein Taha, three young men, were determined, and they knew it. They knew it that at the end they're going to be martyrs during this whole process of liberation movement. And it came actually as an answer to the Israeli incursions and the Israeli aggressions against Gaza. So no matter the Israelis' fierce aggression against the Palestinian, the reaction is even more fierce. Ibrahim, Islam, and Hussein has proven that they are not alone in this battlefield. And the funeral ceremony in Nablus, thousands of people attending this, and thousands of them chanting for the martyrs, this proved that the younger generation is not tolerating anymore of the Israeli aggressions, and they are ready to fight until
it seems
end.
That the upcoming weeks will just bring about more retaliation from the Palestinian people, who cannot take any more of this kind of oppression and aggression from the Zionist entity. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for joining us from the occupied Palestinian West Bank. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about how Hezbollah also is threatening the Israeli entity.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
While the official position in Lebanon is still waiting for the Israeli answer that will be carried to Beirut by the American envoy for indirect negotiations, Amos Hochstein, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, during the Ashura commemorations, upped the ante of his warning speeches against the enemy, sending messages internally and externally that the resistance is ready for war if the Israeli side decides to start drilling for gas in the Karish field on September 1st, especially if an agreement is not mediated between Lebanon and the occupation in the remaining few weeks. Observers say that Hezbollah's position has become stronger, especially after the recent Gaza war, in which the Palestinian resistance factions were able to bombard the settlements in the Gaza enclave and even Tel Aviv with more than 1,000 missiles in just 3 days. Hezbollah threatens war against the Israeli entity in this following report.
In a speech addressing thousands of Lebanese resistance Hezbollah supporters who gathered in the southern suburbs of Beirut, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that the hand that will extend to Lebanon's wealth will be cut, stressing that Lebanon's oil, gas, and water must remain his, and that no one should be allowed to rob the country of its wealth and resources. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that they are waiting for Israel's answers to Lebanese state's demands, stressing that the resistance will make the necessary decisions against the backdrop of the Israeli response, calling for readiness for all possibilities. Sayyid Nasrallah stressed that Lebanon can no longer tolerate the looting of its wealth, threatening Israel not to test Hezbollah. Since the beginning of July, developments related to the file of demarcating the maritime borders between the two sides have accelerated after they stopped for several months, following the arrival of an Israeli production and storage vessel to a place near the Karish field, which Beirut considers to be located in a disputed area in preparation for the start of gas extraction from it. The move prompted Lebanon to demand the resumption of negotiations with American mediation at a time when the American mediator Amos Hochstein was satirical in the visit before his last to Beirut, up until Hezbollah sent drones last month to the Karish field carrying a shocking message to Israel that Hezbollah is more than willing to risk a new war to protect Lebanese wealth and resources. Hezbollah published a video of the incident coinciding with the latest visit of the American mediator Hochstein, putting the Energene platform and other ships in Karish offshore gas field under the watchful eye of the resistance, transforming the American mediator's satirical status into a seriously concerned one. Israel is facing a tough decision that will benefit Lebanon either way. If Lebanon obtains its gas treasure from the sea, which will generate great profits for the state's empty budget, Hezbollah will then prove that his threats terrified Israel, pushing it to give Lebanon back its share. However, in the event Israel refuses to halt looting Lebanese natural gas fields, it will have to face Hezbollah's wrath that will prove to be not only Lebanon's protector in terms of security, but also the protector of its economy. The clock is ticking and the pressure is increasing on both America and Israel. However, an entire year of confrontations with the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, which was able to inflict heavy strikes, one of which was the power station in Ashkelon. Israel fears precise attacks by Hezbollah, which has a more advanced missile and military arsenal compared to the resistance forces in the Gaza Strip.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Ali, now Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah delivered a speech on the day of Ashura in which he conveyed messages all across the region, affirming mainly the readiness, the capabilities, and the preparedness of the resistance against any aggression, and renewing that Lebanon would never concede any of its rights and its resources. What are the odds that the threats between both sides would actually escalate into an all-out war?
Greetings to you. No doubt that the equation put forth by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah concerning Lebanon's acquirement of its maritime rights, which translates into, first, the recognition of the Israeli entity of Lebanon's right in Lebanese international waters, and second, also to allow Lebanon to extract its own oil and gas. This equation pushed a Zionist entity into a real dilemma. They have no more time to maneuver. As you mentioned in your report, the clock is ticking. Of course, this equation apparently was aimed for the Zionist entity, but in reality, the final decision will not be made by Israel. The equation is aimed at the Americans in specific, because the Americans have a big role in pressuring the Zionist entity to make certain decisions concerning the maritime border dispute with Lebanon. So far, we cannot fully say at this moment that there is a possibility of a war or even a confrontation. We have three possible scenarios. First scenario is that Israel backs down and gives in to the Lebanese demands. This way, they avoid a confrontation, and obviously the resistance will claim that position as a victory versus a disappointment in the internal Israeli arena. The second scenario is that Israel goes down the old road of arrogance and refuses to back down from the Lebanese rights in the Mediterranean, which would lead the region towards a confrontation or a war. Now, the third scenario is that the Israeli entity gives in, but after a limited confrontation, or what the Israelis call combating days, between the resistance and the occupation forces. Something like a couple of days of fighting, in a way that would lead to the mediation of international players, like the Americans maybe, in order to find common ground or a possible solution.
But
this is not what the Zionist war minister Benny Gantz said when he threatened to reach Sidon and Beirut if the resistance thought of striking the gas. Yeah, I laughed as well. The gas rigs in the Mediterranean or targeting drilling operations that are intended to begin in September 1st. But that was before the 1,000 rockets that fell on Tel Aviv in the past week and other occupied cities among which were actually coming from the besieged Gaza Strip. Isn't Israel worried about what might come out of Lebanon from Hezbollah?
Of course, no doubt Israel is very worried about what might come from Hezbollah to establish the Lebanese rights. They're also worried about the damage that will be inflicted against Israel's offshore gas facilities erected in occupied Palestinian waters, which are being usurped by the Zionist entity. When it comes to the threats issued by Benny Gantz against Lebanon, the issue is not only about the missiles launched recently from Gaza towards the internal occupied territories. The issue even precedes the liberation in the year 2000. It is no longer acceptable, hypothetical, or even possible for such a threat to be implemented. The time when the Zionist forces were able to occupy cities or do ground invasions to reach capital cities like Beirut is long gone. These are empty, non-harmful threats, threats that have no real value on the ground. The enemy knows that the resistance is monitoring not only the activity on the extraction vessel in Karish, in Karish, but also the words being spoken on board that vessel. They know that pretty well, and they know what the resistance is capable of. In my opinion, I think all these threats issued by Zionist leaders aim only to raise morale inside Israel and possibly to intimidate the Lebanese public. After the latest round of aggression against Gaza, the Zionists falsely believe that they actually achieved victory in Gaza, and they want us to believe it. They idiotically want to push that false belief to intimidate the Lebanese public and the resistance. From that, one can understand why Sayed Nasrallah, in his Ashura speech, was keen on threatening the Zionist entity and reminding them that we are a nation that does not succumb to Zionist threats. Sayed Nasrallah said the Zionists are the ones who should be afraid of Hezbollah threats because Israel has a lot to lose. Meanwhile, the resistance has nothing to lose. There are three choices today between either the Lebanese slowly dying from hunger or to die in confrontation or to achieve a massive victory. The Lebanese public attitude is one that is widely supportive today of the resistance option because they can no longer endure the economic crisis in their country. So it is no longer allowed for the enemy to pirate our rights and steal our wealth.
Yes, but basically this also puts Israel at a very important crossroads in its history, whether it accepts and concedes to the resistance demands or takes the choice of a confrontation that might lead to an all-out war that we don't know who might get involved with it.
many other resistance factions in the region. Which way do you think that Israel will choose to go when we approach September? We still have 10 plus days. Which way do you think they'll go?
I believe that the time limit is not the beginning of September, but possibly mid-September or even the end of September. What the Zionist entity is trying to do now is to extend this time limit by pressuring the gas extraction company to postpone the extraction process by pinning it to technical difficulties. So I think that what Hochstein will bring to the table on his next visit to Lebanon will be to postpone the extraction until an agreement is reached in the ongoing mediated negotiations taking place in Nahura, South Lebanon. But I believe that the Zionists know very well that this dilemma that was created by Sayed Nasrallah will not be solved, neither through a military confrontation nor through a political maneuver. Israel has no choice but to compromise and recognize Lebanon's right in the Mediterranean. And the Americans need to allow the extraction companies that signed agreements with Lebanon, like Consortium, Total, Eni, and Novatek, to begin extraction in Lebanon's Block 9 and the remaining gas blocks. What is happening now is just an Israeli maneuver to try to promote this issue internally because they are approaching Knesset elections in the Zionist entity. So Lapid is trying to insinuate for his people that he did not give in before he tried every possible option. But at the end of the day, we did not want or take you to war. Since we saw what happened to the settlers when for 3 days Gaza rained the internal Palestinian territories in Tel Aviv with missiles, the scenario with Lebanon will be multiplied by 10 times.
السيناريو سيكون مضاعف عشرات المرات مع لبنان وهم يعرفون قدرات المقاومة.
I don't know if the Israelis will be able to put their dead settlers as people who died via accidents the same way that they did with Gaza when that happens and if that happens. But I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, journalist and political researcher and commentator, for joining us to talk about this very stressing matter for Lebanon, for our country. Thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream. Thank you. We'll see you soon.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
انسان نفسش بی نهایت خواهه،
یعنی حد نداره.
The carnal soul of a human is never satisfied and is always hungry for more sins. This point is also mentioned by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in his prayers, where he states that the carnal soul is eager to disobey Allah. The limitations and restrictions on the way of believers by religions are not banning their freedom and do not make them more greedy. The laws and rulings like hijab and ban on open relations between opposite genders does not aggravate the feeling towards sins. This is because the more a person does sins, the more he or she becomes thirsty and greedy. The greed of carnal soul never finishes. Now, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is complaining about such a carnal soul to Allah.
پیغمبر سوال کردن که آقا شما هم شیطان دارید؟ پیغمبر فرمود بله.
Once Prophet Muhammad was asked, are satanic temptations in your carnal soul too? Prophet stated, yes, but my Satan is tamed by me. Here, Prophet Muhammad meant that his carnal soul is under his own control and is not free to commit sins. However, this case is only true about the beloved servants of Allah. We as ordinary people must be very much careful not to be under the control of our carnal soul. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A video comparing the size of the crowds at Donald Trump's and President Joe Biden's rallies this week in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, has gained 1.5 million views on Twitter as of Sunday morning, 4th of September 2022. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Fatima Khaled. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Video Comparing Trump's Biden's Wilkes-Barre Crowds Viewed Over 1.1 Million Times. A video comparing the size of the crowds at Donald Trump's and President Joe Biden's rallies this week in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, has gained 1.5 million views on Twitter as of Sunday morning, 4th of September. The video, which was posted by Newsmax host Benny Johnson, showed a packed venue with Donald Trump's supporters cheering for the former president as he approached the podium. The video footage then cuts to a clip moments later to show Joe Biden address what appears to be a small crowd in his home state of Pennsylvania. The former president was holding the Wilkes-Barre campaign rally on Saturday, 3rd of September, along with endorsees Dr. Mehmet Oz and Doug Mastriano, to attract Republican voters ahead of November's midterm elections. The celebrity physician, Dr. Mehmet Oz, is the Republican Senate nominee for Pennsylvania, who is up against Democratic rival John Fetterman, while Doug Mastriano is running against Democrat Josh Shapiro for governor of Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Joe Biden spoke about his plans to address gun violence and crime during a speech that was also held in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. The president also criticized Republicans for opposing his proposal to restore a ban on assault weapons, urging voters to vote against lawmakers who are against the ban. The video posted by Johnson also gained different reactions on Twitter, with some users criticizing the comparison and pointing out that the crowd sizes don't matter as much as the achievements made by both men and the Democratic and Republican parties. One Twitter user, J.D. Obenfire, tweeted, "I'm okay with my party not worshipping its leaders. We sent them to Washington, D.C. to do a job. I don't need them to even be super great employees. I just need them to do the job we sent them there to do, and I'm content with the job that they're doing under the circumstances." During his first rally since the FBI searched his Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida last month to retrieve classified White House documents, Donald Trump criticized the federal agency, Joe Biden, and the Department of Justice. Trump told his supporters that Biden is an enemy of the state and branded the Department of Justice as vicious monsters. "The FBI and the Justice Department has become vicious monsters, controlled by radical left scoundrels, lawyers, and the media who tell them what to do. You people right there, and when to do it," the former president said. Joe Biden and Donald Trump saw an uptick in popularity in recent weeks for different reasons. A 538 opinion poll published on Friday showed that Joe Biden's approval rate increased to 42.7%, after hitting a low of 37.5% in July. The new opinion poll numbers come after Joe Biden signed a bipartisan gun safety bill in June, announcing that the United States killed al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in August, and most recently revealing a student loan forgiveness plan that will help some American borrowers. Meanwhile, as Donald Trump continues to dominate the news since the FBI raid on his residence at Mar-a-Lago, his popularity recently saw an uptick in several pollsters. But it hasn't climbed through the roof, as he claimed recently, without mentioning the opinion polls that he was referring to. The national tracking poll published by the website Politico for 10th of August showed that 57% of 2004 registered voters surveyed said they would vote for Donald Trump in 2024 primaries, a figure that increased by 4% from the prior month. Meanwhile, an NBC poll released for 21st of August found that 41% of Republican or Republican-leaning participants backed the former president after the raid, compared to 34% in May. Newsweek has reached out to the White House and Donald Trump's office for comment.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences and sorrow and sadness for the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws regarding the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, or in commemoration of his martyrdom, and also Arba'in. Well, before that, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the Islamic laws related to the Arba'een pilgrimage and the mourning ceremony on Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, somebody asked this question. Let me quote. I, along with a few of my friends, collected privately donated monetary pledges or nazurat for the purpose of funding the religious ceremonies associated with the Arba'een season. A portion of the pledged funds remain unused during the recent Arba'een season, and they will remain unused until the next Arba'een season, for the funds were pledged specifically for use during the Arba'een season. Now, there are two questions in this connection. First, can we deposit this unused portion with a bank in a savings account and use the earned interest toward funding the religious ceremonies of the next Arba'een season? And second, the second question, the funds are currently deposited in a non-interest bearing Qarz al-Hasana bank account. Is it canonically permissible to deposit funds in non-interest bearing bank accounts?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As to the first question, depositing the surplus of the pledged funds mm-hmm. in a savings account is permissible,
yes,
provided that number one, it is carried out with the consent of the donors, and number two, the earned interest results from a contract that is sanctioned by Islamic law. So, first of all, we see that the consent of the donors is very important. It cannot be used for any purpose other than the purpose for which the donated amount has been donated or given, and it should not be used against that purpose. And secondly, if it is deposited in a bank account, it should be, of course, based on the Sharia law. For example, it cannot be invested or deposited in a bank on based on interest or usury, because usury is forbidden. So if it is approved by Sharia law, there is no problem in investing that bank or in receiving the interest from the contract. And when it comes to the second question, of course, it is permissible to deposit money in a non-interest bearing bank account. Mm-hmm. There is no interest, so you can just put it in a bank account and it will be saved there until the next Arbaeen season and during which it can be withdrawn and used for the same purpose for which the money was donated, of course.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. A very quick question regarding wudu. Can we make wudu using the bottled water donated for the Arbaeen pilgrims? If, of course, it has not been specified whether or not they are donated specifically for the purpose of drinking.
Well, according to His Eminence and the very scenario mm-hmm. mentioned in the question, it is not permissible to use bottled water for any purpose other than drinking. Of course, unless one is certain that it's allowed by the donors, because some donors may give their consent or allow these bottles to be used for making wudu. But unless it's clear that they are consenting to it, it is not permissible to use those bottled waters, of course, the bottled water for making wudu. They should be used for, of course, drinking only.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get thirsty, you start to melt and say to me,
Sheikh Javid, many of people, believers, who want to participate in the Arbaeen pilgrimage, instead they volunteer in some of the mawakib or the makeshift rest stations, which are usually set up, in fact, in Najaf and Karbala or some of the cities involved, along the way, or the villages even, right? And they remain there and they serve the believers and the pilgrims, okay?
Yes.
Though I know that they choose to serve the pilgrims, they are themselves considered pilgrims, aren't they? Well, so a question remains here. Is it permissible to use some of the donations made by people and the other believers for funding such ceremonies? I mean, the ceremonies of the Arbaeen pilgrimage, in order to pay for their own expenses needed for the transportation of volunteers, for example, including the fee for obtaining their visas and their travel costs?
As you rightly mentioned, of course, some of these people who volunteer themselves to work in these makeshift stations or mawakib, they frequent between Haram and their mawqif very often, and of course,
right,
they have their own individual expenses. Now, the question may arise to some people as to whether they are permitted or not. Of course, Ayatollah Khamenei says that it depends on the intention of the donors. If their intention in offering their donations is general, that's to say, they do not have a specific uses in mind, it is permissible to use a part of the donations for the purpose, of course, prescribed for the purpose described in the question. Now, for example, the travel costs or the visas and everything that is necessary, because they are working for the makeshift stations.
Mm-hmm.
So anything related to the makeshift stations, including those pilgrims who may have to get visas and also travel from one place to another place, or from their country of origin to those to Karbala or to Iraq or to some of the cities, they need some money to spend. Of course, it is permissible to spend it. And of course, as mentioned by His Eminence, it depends largely on the intention of the donors.
Mm.
If the donation is general, and the purpose is not specific, it's not specified by the donors, then a portion of that donated money can be spent for these purposes.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, another question would be related to the overwhelming crowds that converge in Karbala on the day of Arba'in, which makes it very difficult for some of these pilgrims, in fact, who attempt to enter the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and even the sacred distance between the shrines of Abul Fadl al-Abbas and Imam al-Hussein. For some, it is practically impossible, Sheikh Javid,
yes,
all right, to do so. And trying to push one's way through people may hurt fellow pilgrims.
Sure.
As such, can we pay our respects and tribute to Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, from the closest spot that we can approach to the shrine, that we can reach, for example, and without having to hustle going through the crowd and conclude our pilgrimage there, or should we enter the holy shrine?
Yes, I have experienced it myself. Thousands of people wish, or millions of people wish to touch the chamber of the zarih of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam.
Yes.
And they think that unless they reach the zarih, mm. their ziyara will not be accepted.
Right.
Well, according to His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, it is permissible to conclude one's pilgrimage,
mm-hmm,
at a distance from the holy shrine, and it's not necessary at all to make oneself or one's hand reach or touch the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And as you yourself might have gone, of course, there's so much pressure around the chamber that you feel like you will have one of your ribs or broken at the end. So that's why it's very much necessary. And also, as a measure of precaution, one should avoid going very close to the chamber, because there is danger of getting your ribs broken, or even fainting,
right,
near the chamber. So it is quite correct. It's valid to do the ziyarah from a distance in order to be safe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program. Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.